everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And like I wrote today, I have great guests on, and they wrote a fabulous book. My guests are David Fantel and Tom Johnson, and they wrote Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interview with Golden Age Legends, and it is a great book for all us true classic movie people. I mean, they probably had last interviews with so many people. Hi, guys. Welcome.
Hi. How are you doing?
Hey, how are you?
I'm swell.
Good.
So glad that we're talking, finally.
Yeah.
Exactly. We connected.
Yay. So what's up?
You know, here we are at in the winter, and, you know, we've lost in the last week or so two of the artists who we've interviewed and are profiled in Hollywood Heyday. And, of course, of the 75 interviews that are in there, like you said, we know in the case of Mike Connors, who played Mannix, we actually did, we believe, almost certainly have the last interview. But in this book and in a timely manner, we just lost Stanley Donen, the great director, arguably the last director of the Golden Age, with co-directing Singing in the Rain and On the Town and It's Always Fair Weather with Kelly, but having an outstanding solo directorial career with Royal Wedding and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and Two for the Road and Funny Face, what have you. We lost Stanley. We have two interviews with him in a chapter that were done almost 40 years apart, including just about 40 years ago. And then we just got the news recently that we lost the maestro, Andre Previn, who had an illustrious career, child prodigy at MGM, was, you know, going to high school and working at the studio at age 16. By the time he gave up on Hollywood, and he was not even 35 years old, he left with four Academy Awards to his name.
God.
And he just passed away at 89. And we had one of the last interviews with him 3 years ago.
It was a very good interview.
Very colorful. I mean,
yes.
He was very reluctant to go back to what he called ancient history. He sort of had left the Hollywood years in the rearview mirror, and it took some persuasion on our part to actually get him to consent. But once we got him in person at his place, and once he started talking, he really dished on a lot of people that he worked with.
I love that. Boy, I wish I could. Oh, I wish I could have been there. And his Robert Wagner interview, 3 hours. Oh, my God. We'll get to that later.
Yeah, that was a long one.
He did, too.
I know. And I know you didn't put all the dishing in there. There was too much to give. Because he wrote great
books. Yeah, we kept a few things out.
Yeah, I do. Who's the one who told you you look like Art Carney, Tom?
Oh, that was, who did tell me like that? That was kind of a conversation stopper. I think that was RJ, as he likes to be called after you've met him, you've hung out with him for about 3 minutes. He insists that you call him RJ instead of Robert, but he's a real sweet guy.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I would love to.
And he just had his 89th birthday, and I mean, he is phenomenal.
He's incredible. I think he's going to be at TCM Film Festival.
Yeah, he just keeps going, which is terrific.
And with Stanley Donen, was he the one? Did Yvette Mimieux come out naked?
Yeah, that was kind of that was our first interview in the early 80s. We were young kids, and we were there. We were kind of waiting in his office, in his den, and then I guess he came in from the shower and didn't know that he had had an interview scheduled with two young reporters.
She comes
flouncing in through the French doors, completely nude, without a stitch on, and screamed, ran out, and then we could hear this muffled argument with her and Stanley, you know, in another room. And then when he comes in for the interview, the first time we met him, he was just pissed. I mean, he's pissed at us. He was, you know, like it was this major transgression when, I mean, it wasn't like we were voyeuring or anything. We were sitting on the sofa, you know,
waiting,
as we were told.
Yes.
Yeah, and he came in, and everything was monosyllabic. Every answer to every question we had was like, yes, fine, good. You know, I mean, it was really, and
but
it kind of hated at the end.
It was, you know, for Tom and I at the time we were probably 19 or 20, we were college students, you know, this was almost 40 years ago, so, you know, to see a vet, it was sort of distracting, and we had a hard time, you know, of recalibrating the questions. But when
wasn't altogether a bad thing, if you know. Yeah.
I know what you mean.
Oh my God.
I know what you
without
mean.
Without being politically incorrect, which you can't do in 2019, you know that.
Right. You know, but I get you. Yeah.
But and then 40 years later, we had the second interview with him when he was in his, you know, in about
late
90. 80s.
Yeah,
you know, back in New York City at the San Remo, that great apartment building on Central Park West.
That's where he had his office. Yeah.
And we were quaking a little bit going in there, thinking, oh, God, what if he remembers us? You know, which was ridiculous because he totally didn't remember who we were. And then we had just a real nice sort of sit down with him where he talked about his idol, Fred Astaire. It was as he worshipped him. In fact, he had a gigantic picture of Fred, huge picture of Fred in evening dress in his office, you know, which was kind of interesting to see. And then
yes,
he had his honorary Oscar there. And he was a sweetheart. And Dave even pulled out a picture of him that we had taken, yes, you know, 40 years, 30 years before. And, you know, he said he didn't remember it. And we were both sort of breathed a sigh of relief because I think if he would have remembered it, we would have maybe been booted out of his office for, you know, the second time in our, you know, lives of meeting him, you know.
So but, you guys didn't say.
It was fine.
We saw Yvette.
No.
Stone Cold
no,
nude.
We didn't.
I know.
This was like, this was probably two or three wives later, ensuing years.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, 40 years. Yeah. They don't
yeah.
Stay
so for
like
the
that.
Last several years, he's been, he was with Elaine May.
Elaine
they
May,
never
yeah.
got married, but yeah, that was his
oh, wow.
girlfriend. Yeah.
His constant sort of, yeah.
His constant companion. His,
exactly.
His
significant other. Okay.
Yep, exactly.
So I
but, you know, Stanley Donen was interesting. I mean, he's mentioned Robert Wagner references him and, you know, and of course he's so intricately linked, you know, with the work of Gene Kelly and he was Gene Kelly's protege and, Kelly, you know, very generously, you know, let him co-direct that first film On the Town together, and they did three films together. And then when Stanley flew solo, of course, he had an outstanding directorial career on his own. And, you know, it's sort of sad that the passing of, as I said, arguably, you know, the last of the significant directors who worked in the 40s and beyond.
It's sad. It is.
Yeah.
You guys were so lucky, but I want you to tell the listeners how you started, because you guys had some chutzpah, some nerve. As RJ says, audacity.
Yeah, we had more nerve than sense probably back when we – but when, you know, you're 18, 16, you know, you don't know from anything, so you just go for it. And, yeah, Dave and I, you know, we – it was really – that's entertainment, the movie that came out in – what was it?
1974. Yeah, we were 15 years old.
Yeah, we saw that, and that was really created the engine behind wanting to interview a lot of these people. We just love that compilation of MGM musical moments, and, you know, we wanted to see the films from which these clips came. So we, and, you know, you couldn't see them way, but way, way, way back then. There were no VCRs or anything
no,
like that.
No TCM. Oh, my.
Yeah, nothing. It was just the Late Show, you know, if you were lucky enough to see one on the Late Show every once in a while. So we started a film society, called the Song and Nerve, called Films on Wheels. Yeah, and we brought these
so
films
nice.
To we brought them to nursing homes and you know, all these films, and then we split the cost among them to rent them. They were 16mm films that we had to thread through one of those old Bell and Howell projectors, you know, because we, again, there was no you know, wasn't automated. You had to do it yourself. And so we saw all these great musicals, and then, you know, Dave and I said, well, wouldn't it be great if we could, you know, interview some of the people? A lot of them are still alive. They're in their golden years, but maybe we can see them. And then we started a two-year snail mail correspondence with Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire's secretaries. And then eventually in 1978, we got the green light
We beat them into submission.
All right, I'll see him already.
Well, so, just to put it in perspective, this all occurred, Tom and I both grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
So here we were in the, you know, the Midwest, infatuated with these classic old films. We started mm-hmm. with musicals and certainly branched out to a lot of different genres mm-hmm. of classic Hollywood films. And, you know, it seems incredible when we talk to groups and things today that, you know, you would send a self-addressed stamped envelope to Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, and they would, stars of that era, actually, if they didn't respond, someone on their behalf actually did. And so we started this at age 15 when we saw That's Entertainment, started Films on Wheels when we could finally drive at age 16.
It's so cute.
And then at age 18, when we graduated high school, June of 1978, before we started at the University of Minnesota, was when we made that first trip and had these, you know, incredible, relatively short, but incredible visits with individually with Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. And Tom and I always say the snapshot that we each had with Fred Astaire was really our Willy Wonka golden ticket, because they were so universally revered. It just opened all the doors. So then we started using the Astaire photo with us and writing letters and sending some newspaper clips. And, you know, it just mushroomed. During college, we started writing these interviews up in the Minnesota Daily at the University of Minnesota. And during our college years, we did 75, 80 of these interviews and flew out sometimes 2 to 3 weeks at a time. Wow. And then we sort of continued this up until about the mid-90s. When there were still, you know, people like Eva Marie Saint and Rod Steiger, and we did Charlton Heston on his second time, you know, so there were still, you know, Janet Leigh, these people were around. And then Tom and I sort of, I guess you could say, sort of looked at the last vestige of these people over the last maybe 5-6 years, and that's where we had Stanley Donen, number two, and Robert Wagner, Mike Connors, George Hamilton, Leslie Caron. So, you know, we sort of captured within the last 5 years, you know, a handful of people that, you know, we said, gosh, they're still around.
They're still kicking.
Sort of,
and they're lucid. So let me go.
Yeah, well, that's
that's a big
one. That's a prerequisite. We really don't want to see them if they're not lucid.
You know, there's people that didn't make the book, for example. You know, we saw, 94-year-old Nanette Fabre literally, you know, under the sheets of her bed.
Oh, and why did they let you go in? Yeah.
I don't know.
She had a housekeeper, and she lived right off of Sunset Boulevard, you know, kind of in this swale down in these wooded area, in this big house. And she'd lived there for years and years, and she was just, you know, she was literally in bed under the covers, and that's where we did the interview, where we were just, you know, we kind of put the little, you know, the microphone
digital
kind of near face. Yeah, and, you know, and we had, and she was totally okay with it, you know, but it was just sort of, it was one of the more bizarre settings that, you know, mm-hmm. we had, because she was literally bedridden. But
and some of
but
it, I mean,
totally
again, we know that these are oral histories, mm-hmm. and, you know, sometimes people take issue when they say what one star remembered about something, what have you. I mean, it's sort of like the Gene Kelly Singing in the Rain was Debbie Reynolds forced on him, and of course, you know, he says no, and Debbie, when you interviewed her, sort of said yes. So, you know, it's sort of different oral histories. But in the case of people like Nanette, you know, there wasn't a lot of coherent conversation that we could actually cobble together. I guess the other one that did make the cut in the book, but was this by that point, certainly had a state of dementia, but we put him in, was Mervyn LeRoy, sort of one of the last of the moguls, produced Wizard of Oz, and he was a producer director. And it's sort of a relatively interesting interview, but again, we sort of felt there was much, he was losing it. And in the case of Mickey Rooney, you know.
Well, the thing about LeRoy was that we don't know whether he's losing it or whether he was just, you know, he's forgetful from the get-go. Because, I mean, there are all kinds of stories going even 20 years before we interviewed him where he was just sort of this guy. He was sort of like a stream of consciousness guy that was very, very, you know, sort of nonverbal, and that, you know, he was just kind of strange that way. So, yeah, I mean, he might have been kind of, you know, sort of at the, you know, in the early stages of dementia, or that might have just been something that he, you know, his natural way of sort of communicating from, you know, early on.
And then another one is Mickey Rooney. You know, Mickey Rooney, who you never really knew what, if anything, he was saying was true or not. And, you know, he came, he was at a hotel in the L.A. area. And, you know, he was just, it was sort of, what would you say, Tom? He was spewing sort of these random political thoughts. And
I mean, and it was all sort of self-promotion stuff. So it was kind of this, he was like this weird advertisement for things that he was doing or wanted to do or had in his mind to do, which was interesting. I mean, it was sort of funny.
But sad in a way as well.
Yeah, sad. But, I mean, what was really sad was that, you know, there was an older lady that was sort of circling us during the interview, and she kind of recognized him but couldn't quite, you know, put her finger on maybe who he was. And then she finally figured it out. She came over and said, "Oh, Mr. Rooney, I've loved you, and you're great, and whatever, whatever." And he just said, "Well, dear, can't you tell I'm doing an interview? You're interrupting us. Get away." And
he sort of
I felt horrible for her because it was like, here's probably the one fan in Westlake Village in L.A. that, like, recognizes him, and he kind of booted her out of, the area where we were interviewing, and I would have been fine with her, getting an autograph.
And his whole ending, but, I mean, here's a guy who went through – well, Tom and I joked that, that we have two people in the book between Artie Shaw and Mickey Rooney that had combined 16 wives.
Wow.
And I think we said they had like one or two in common, didn't they? Or at least one.
Ava Gardner.
Yeah.
Not at the same time, no.
But, Artie Shaw's another example. I mean, the thing about some of the interviews in the book is, they weren't all like, here's one and done. Here's these college students. I mean, in the case of Heston, there was a couple interviews. In the case of Gene Kelly,
George Burns
was 3-4 interviews. Hope was 2 interviews. Gene Kelly, we went back to his home, the first one in 78 and then about 1992. Mm. And Eva Marie Saint, a couple of interviews. Ed Asner, a couple of interviews.
So, I love him. I interviewed him. We got engaged.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy. Yeah. Wonderful guy. Yeah.
So accessible.
Did you guys get engaged? I got engaged to him, and within we did, I think, a 40-minute podcast, and we were engaged by the end of it.
he's wonderful.
He's a pooky bear. Yeah. I love him.
Yeah, he really is.
So generous.
He really is a darling. But he was 87 and sharp as a freaking tack when I talked to him.
And he's very active on Twitter and social media. God bless him.
I love him.
He'd never admit it, but he has a lot of spunk.
Yes, I talked to him because that's what
the old Mary Tyler Moore line. But
I love that. He told me
something.
Because I said when I posted it, I put the little clip of him telling Mary that she has spunk. And then he just laughed and he said, you know what? I like spunk. I really like spunk.
He does.
So generous. He tweeted about the book and, basically said, I'm honored to be in the presence of the other people that are in the book. And, that was
sweetheart.
He's a real darling. So it's so nice to find people like him. Okay, let's talk about your this one stood out, and but I adore him, Fred Astaire. He was your first interview. How were you guys? Were you nervous as anything? Ready to barf? Or were you just like, oh, we're cool?
Well, we were. He and Gene, because as Dave said, when we came out, we were 18 and we weren't legal to drive in L.A. So we had to find kind of a budget hotel real near where these interviews took place, which we did as a Beverly Terrace Motor Hotel. It's still around, and we walked to both of the interviews. And Fred was he was in the flatlands of Beverly Hills on Brighton Way. That was where his
office
was.
Flatlands.
I know. And we walked over there, and I remember we walked in on him, and he was, like, sitting at a desk. It was his accountant's office, and he was sitting at his desk balancing his checkbook. So he didn't see us come in. We came up behind him, and there are a lot of zeros in his checks. I mean, I'm telling you, the guy had a bank account. But it was he was an absolute sweetheart, great guy, as self-effacing and diffident and nice as you've ever seen him on screen. That was really kind of who he was. He was, he sprang up. He said, sit down. He was the ultimate gentleman. And Dave, you can tell
a couple things. I always say that what came across is Tom and I actually bought our first suits, and we always wore suits and ties on these visits as college students. Just because we wanted to
send me a picture of that. That must be so cute. Do you have the picture of Fred Astaire too?
With Astaire, we have our first suits.
Please,
on. And of course, Astaire, was Natalie dressed as always.
Smelled like cedar chest.
That
made me sad.
Blue blazer, the tie. But, the thing I came away with, and you think about that time of 40 years ago, is that he was so unaware of his genius.
Yeah.
And you say, were we nervous? I guess to a certain extent. But, when you're sitting with him, he was so, modest that, it was like you were sitting with your grandfather at the time. And, now, of course, as the years gone on, you go, gosh, you were, sitting across from an artist that, you could put in the same breath, arguably, as, Mozart or Beethoven or any great genius artist in history. And, we told him about our films and Wheels, and that we showed Easter Parade at one of the nursing homes, and one of the senior citizens commented to us and said, oh, this is great, thinking we had made it as our own home movie. And Astaire was like, what? Well, you know, sort of laughing. He goes, he thought you made that, you know, and but he lived for the moment. You know, he talked about disco dancing and he voted for John Travolta for best actor. You know, after our visit, he broke his ankle trying to like skateboard with his like grandson down his steep driveway in his Beverly Hills. So even as he got into the late 70s and early 80s, he just, you know, lived for the moment. And, you know, he was just a regular guy from Omaha, Nebraska, who happened to enter show business when he was six or seven years old.
Yeah. And Artie Shaw, you know, the great clarinetist who had worked with Fred Astaire in 1940 in Second Chorus, this really kind of not a great film, but he had worked with him, and he gave one of the greatest definitions of what he thought Fred was like. And you know, Artie was a really... He was, you know, by the time we saw him, he was an author, and you know, and he said that Astaire was, his greatness was amazing because he was a great artist and also a great popular entertainer. So he was, you know, because great artists often aren't popular with the public, and popular entertainers often don't attain great art status. He said Astaire was great. Astaire bridged both of those sort of idioms, which was really, you know, that was kind of interesting, and it's actually true, because he, you know, when you think of what he's done, Fred was, you know, absolutely unique, a great artist. People from Baryshnikov to Nureyev to Balanchine say that in you know, the classical ballet world, and he was a great popular entertainer, you know, in addition to that. He made that art popular to the masses, so that's no small achievement. And
no,
that's what, you know, Artie had said, which we thought was really kind of an interesting, you know.
And was he, you know, was thing. You know, when you think about it, and you know, we're all on social media sites with all the us fellow film geeks and all
yes.
this stuff, and you know, you see all the arguments, and you know, Kelly, you know, was a taskmaster, and he made Debbie Reynolds' feet bleed and whatever. But the reality is, to make the art that these guys did wasn't necessarily pretty. And, it, you know, so if there were tempers flaring and disagreements and artistic things, so be it. That's not a big deal. The product is what speaks for itself, and the work of a Gene Kelly and a Fred Astaire speaks for itself. Much of it stands the test of time.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, by the time we saw people like Gene Kelly in 78, and then, you know, many, many years later, you know, he was the warmest, nicest, you know, congenial guy.
Right. And I mean, you know, when you create great movies like that, it's not about a popularity contest. I mean, great, you know, artists or creative people, you know, they're usually, you know, to get to the position where they were able to make a Singing in the Rain or a Seven Brides for Seven Brothers or a Bandwagon or anything, I mean, you know, they're not there for popularity reasons. They're there, and especially if they're auteurs or if they're directing and if they have responsibility there, they got to be taskmasters. That's just the way, you know, you get the vision that you want on screen. You know, you have to make Debbie Reynolds' feet bleed in order for you to come up with the Good Morning Number or whatever. I mean,
but to infer that these people, you know, making this great art were a-holes or whatever, that's ridiculous.
I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, right? I've always thought about it.
Okay, so we're talking, you guys, this was before Fred married that little jockey chick, right?
Correct.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. We may not have seen him had he married the jockey chick.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Robin,
you're right.
Robin Astaire.
She's still living in the home. She's non-responsive to anyone who reaches out to her. She's still living among his belongings, from what little we can tell. And yeah, she's still in the house.
And RJ is not a big fan.
I loved that. Oh, God, I loved it. Yeah, and he was right. He was right, because that vacuum thing, I'm sorry. And she said that I was reading some articles on her and People, and she said she actively pursued Fred when she was in L.A.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So she was.
Well, the interesting thing is, there's nothing wrong with keeping a legacy alive and trying to keep them alive for future generations. That's, you know, what TCM tries to do. That's what we all try to do. But the thing is, I'm not sure what Robin has ever done to that end. Whereas, you know, our first interview with Gene, he was widowed, and he was raising his two kids, and he was not married for the final time when we first saw him. The second time, he was with Patricia, who was married to him, his last wife. And So we had an opportunity to meet her. We know her a little bit to this day, but you know, she is sort of tirelessly, you know, working to keep his legacy alive. And I mean, to some extent, I think that needs to be applauded.
I do,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, she's a kind of a one-woman show. She has this Gene Kelly, the legacy kind of thing that she, you know, goes all over the country and you know, talks about Gene, and you know, and which is nice. I mean, you know, whereas, you know, Robin, unfortunately, even when Ginger, I think, was going to be honored by the AFI for life achievement, she wouldn't allow clips of, of their
that
numbers
was horrible.
Together, which, I mean, you know, that's kind of mean-spirited.
That
I mean,
is very
you know,
mean-spirited.
I don't know. I mean,
I don't know the motivation. I don't get the motivation.
Well, there was supposed to be, you know, there was rumors she wanted to be, you know, paid for it or whatever. But I don't, you know, she always gave me this. But if she made Fred happy, but I know she cut him off from his friends. But if he had some happiness, he was 81,
and, you know,
she was 35.
What happened to Fred and Gene in late life matrimony, I mean, isn't the only time that's ever happened. And again, I mean, Tom and I are not going to sit there and cast judgments on those decisions.
No, it's not our place. It's not our place.
Of course not.
Really.
It isn't. Right. But I just, I don't.
James Cagney had a kind of an overseer, you know, in his last years.
She
this
used
woman
to be
named Marge Zimmerman.
Yeah, she was like, what? She sold fruit and stuff?
She and her husband had a general store that the Cagneys went to.
In upstate New York.
And she became his. But again, you know, she pushed him late in life per doctor's orders to get back to work to some extent after he had retired, you know, for 25 years. And, you know, so some say that what she did actually extended his life. Who knows? But so.
And then there's the infamous Aaron Fleming with Groucho Marx thing, which
most
people think that was kind of a disaster. But
and then she ended up committing suicide.
Oh, did she? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she became a street person in L.A.
Oh, how sad.
She kind of lost it. Yeah, it was actually very sad.
So these aren't unusual, these
late-life
relationships.
No, they are not.
No.
But you just hope. No. I know, because I read, I think, Glenn... What's that guy? Courtship of Eddie Glenn Ford. He married somebody. He married a lot of like one of his.
He was married to Eleanor Powell for a long, you know. For
Well,
and Hope Lang, I think, wasn't
he dated her? He dated her.
Yeah,
and she used to make fun of him because he was square.
Well, Frank Capra didn't like him at all.
Well, Betty Davis didn't really like him either.
Yeah.
Because
he was in Capra's last film, A Pocket Full of Miracles.
Full of Miracles.
And
right.
He said he pulled for Betty to get the job and all this other stuff. And Betty wasn't too happy with that. So I want to ask about one of your interviews, which cracked me up. Tippi Hedren.
at her game reserve.
Right? Yes,
yeah.
Yes. What did
Chambala.
And
Tippi came from our home state of Minnesota, and you know, you can't argue with, you know, Hitchcock's taste in some of his leading ladies, whether it was Grace Kelly, Eva Marie Saint, Janet Leigh, Tippi Hedren. She was gorgeous, and even, you know, again, Tom and I saw her many years ago. And her litmus test was whether she was going to eat on any given day was if she could get into her jeans.
I know, that was a funny thing. Yeah, so I'm reading it, and she said, there's more to life than watching TV and eating. She said, Americans are so fat.
Yeah,
right. And this is as she throws like 300-pound slabs of meat to the tigers and stuff that were on her preserve. I mean, oh, my God, she's a woman with a mission with that stuff. Yeah.
It disgusts me, she said.
Yeah, and it's very admirable what she's done.
Oh, I do. I love that. But
it's
totally
admirable.
Diatribe against fat people.
Here's someone whose, you know, career was cut short or potential, was cut short.
That was terrible.
Whether it was because of the Hitchcock arrangement after she made Marnie, I'm not sure. She certainly was not. She sort of threw Hitch under the bus.
Personal service contract that she had signed that apparently just wasn't, you know.
And Hitchcock was known to hold grudges. You know, he was trying to get Grace Kelly back for a film after
Marnie.
She was already pre-yes. And she says almost yes and then no. And then, you know, she became on his, you know, SHIT list. And, you know,
Grace did?
Yeah,
But she wanted to do it, but.
Yeah, but it,
Prince Rainer said, you can't be a thief, a liar, you're the Princess of Monaco. You can't be having love scenes with Sean Connery. You can't be, murdered somebody because your mother was a hooker.
Hitchcock could hold some grudges, I think,
but that's just the way it was. It was a kind of a simpler era that way. We're more cut and dried about stuff like that, it seems like.
I don't know. Tippi probably wanted to get away from him because he ate too much. He disgusted her. Oh, my God.
He wasn't putting jeans on either, I don't think.
Huh? Yeah.
Even then.
He was not putting jeans on.
No,
I don't think you'd ever see Hitchcock wearing a pair of jeans.
Oh, my. Could you imagine?
No, I don't think so.
But I loved him. I love that portly genius.
His work is outstanding. I mean, it's amazing.
His films. Okay, so tell us about Virginia Mayo, Baked Alaska. What'd you think?
It was a little strange. I mean, we took her out to this place. I think it's still there. It's Boccaccio was the name of it.
And, expensive by our standards.
Very expensive. And, I mean, we were penniless students back then.
Did you pay?
So
you paid?
Yeah, of course
you
we did.
You gentlemen.
I mean, when we drove up to her, we were able to drive at that point. And we drove up to her place, and I think she lived out in Westlake somewhere out in the valley. And then and she was dressed to the nines. I mean, she was really looking forward to this. I don't think she got out a lot. So it was great. I mean, we went there and all of that, and, she ordered for dessert. We had a real nice chat, and then for dessert, she ordered Baked Alaska, which, comes on a cart, and it's the waiter lights it up, and it sort of flames and all that. And then she kind of parroted that classic last line of the film she was in with James Cagney called White Heat, where he blows himself up in the oil refinery finale, and he goes, made it my top of the world. And that's what she said. She kind of yelled it. So everyone was looking over at us while this Baked Alaska is flaming up, and she goes, made it my top of the world. And we just thought, we would have paid double for that dessert just to hear those words. That was so classic. It was just great. It was the perfect capper to that.
Just to set the record straight, the most of the people that we would meet, if we did meet for dinner or lunch or breakfast or coffee, foot the bill. I mean, she was a rare exception. Jackie.
So was Fester.
Uncle Coogan, Jackie Fester was a rare exception. Yeah. Uncle Fester, like Bob Newhart, we had breakfast with him.
He sounds like a darling. I love the interview.
Yeah, and he foot the bill for that. And
Cagney treated us to dinner, so that.
Love James Cagney. I just love him.
How do you not?
I just read for the first time, so I know he was faithful to his wife, but he said that there Merle Oberon. He almost gave in because she was vamping him when they were on some war tour. But he resisted her, that trial.
That sounds like James.
Oh, he's so cute.
I think Jim Cagney is indicative of, the Hollywood star making machine. You had someone who was, 5'6", 5'7", had a unique voice. He had a unique look with the red hair.
Loved him.
He wasn't what you'd call classically handsome. He had freckles, and they, of course, made. But every role, regardless of the bad films he was in, he made every role he was in interesting.
He did.
By the sheer force of his personality. And that's what many of the stars, whether it's a Bogart, a Betty Davis, a Jimmy Stewart, the power of their personality could overcome some of those horrible scripts that they were forced to act in. Whereas today's stars, while they're excellent actors, don't get me wrong, today, I don't think they have the power to overcome bad scripts quite as much as some of those other stars did.
Well,
yeah.
Mostly now they're making a lot of, CGI
comic
stuff.
Book.
Yeah,
yes,
so that's kind of total turnoff. Yeah. But there are some great actors out there. I'm not saying that, but I am a classic movie.
There are.
I am a classic. How about Mantan, George Hamilton? This guy kills me. I mean, how was his skin? I mean, he really must be Leatherface by now.
Well, he must moisturize, I guess.
I think,
is he, an A-lister? Of course not. But the reality was, the interesting thing that we got him not too long ago, probably about 8 years ago, was that he was one of the last of the people that actually signed a studio contract, in the late 50s at MGM. And again, got very colorful stories on how he lobbied for that role in Night at the Piazza.
Light at the Piazza with Yvette Menu.
Yvette, yeah, the
yeah.
last film.
Our old buddy.
Yeah, Miss, you saw her naked, yeah.
Yeah,
that was a weird movie, wasn't it?
We saw more of her than probably George Hamilton did when he was filming with her. So,
well, yeah, a lot of it was shot in Florence. That was actually producer Arthur Freed's last film that he produced.
It was before he left MGM.
He sort of warmed the desk at MGM for most of the decade, but he never made another film. But and how he lobbied for that role wasn't it Benny Tsao that I Tom the studio.
It seems funny that he would do that. I was like, wow, George really went to town here.
Is it 100% true or is there a little fabrication?
I feel that there was a little, probably, but, you know, who knows? That's his story.
I think, Grace, it's an interesting lesson in light of, you know, developments the last couple years with Harvey Weinstein and the deplorable stuff he did to, you know, Benny Tsao, you know, if you Google and look, was considered like the king of the casting couch. And, you know, what the stories that Hamilton tells, you know, certainly affirms that reputation.
Yeah, well, right. There were a lot of them. Think of it, a lot of them, you know, a lot of women.
It did not start with Harvey Weinstein.
No, it did not. And people knew about Harvey Weinstein for many, many years.
Yes,
I knew about Harvey Weinstein for about 20 years.
It was sort of a secret everyone knew about.
Yeah, right. So to me, that people are so shocked that are in the business, it's like, oh, please, come on.
Right. Grow up.
Yeah, they knew. I want to ask you, now this guy I love, and, you know, I've begun to love him more since I've done this podcast because I have, you know, my pages, and I try to find really cool pictures, like candids and things like that. And I've seen so many of Gregory Peck that I've fallen in love with him. You know he's dead. I know all that stuff. But he was so cute. He's not one of my favorite top 10 actors, but what he's done great. What was he like to you guys? Because you know what? I think a lot of people think he's stiff. He's like a no fun kind of stiff kind of.
Well, he was very serious. When we met him, but he was very gracious too. We met him at his house, and we sat out on the terrace, and he had a sort of a houseboy bring us this big box of separate teas, and we could select what tea we wanted, which was cute. And he had this German Shepherd named Howard that was chewing on a Hawaiian Tropic bottle the whole time. And so, like our tape recording of it is, you know, punctuated by these crunches of Howard, you know, eating up this bottle. And but he was real sweet. He was a nice guy, and you know, when he'd laugh, we were, you know, talking about the boys from Brazil, about certain Roman holiday, all kinds of things. And he had great stories. And yeah, I wouldn't say he was stiff, but he also wasn't like, you know, a cut up like some of the comedians.
He was a very solid, reliable actor, and
he talked about
Gentleman's Agreement, how at the time it was sort of trendsetter, the first film to deal with anti-Semitism.
Right after World War II.
Seems very mild today, but it's funny you mentioned the photo. The story behind the photo that's in the book is that he was wearing shorts, khaki shorts in the photo, and he consented, as many of them, not all did, that are in the book, but he just had one requirement. He says, please shoot me from the waist up. In other words, he didn't want his legs exposed. Now, nothing wrong with his legs. They were a little gangly, but that was his only requirement for taking the photo.
Well, he still looked like a dish to me. And you know what movie?
He
talked about Atticus Finch and how rewarding that role was. You know, it's hard to make a good person. It's hard to act if the person is as white as the driven snow, like a George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life or Atticus Finch. But he said the fulfilling part was when he and his wife for years and years after would walk in, let's say, Manhattan, people would stop him on the street and say, you know, I went into law school and I'm practicing law because I was inspired by your performance in To Kill a Mockingbird.
So he was amazing.
He was also very generous when he, when Roman Holiday was being filmed. He knew almost from the first rushes that he said Audrey Hepburn is going to win an Oscar for this, and she did. It was her debut film. She won an Oscar. He was the first one to say that, and he said she needs to get equal billing with me because she is going to be fantastic in this movie. And he fought for that, for her. He
that
didn't
is
have to
really,
do it.
No, most people
yeah,
won't
I mean, he's a good guy, very good yeah. guy.
You know what? I'm sorry, go on, David.
I was just going to say sort of the other sort of counterpart of contemporary was another guy who was, you know, again, very similar in demeanor, and that was Charlton Heston. And, you know, again, incredibly gracious, had us into yeah. his home on two different occasions, very
yeah,
open,
nice guy.
Very frank, talked about, you know, politics and being a conservative mm-hmm. and talked about working with the mill and William Wyler and just what we went all over the map during the two visits with him. And that's why I always say politically they were certainly different. But again, old school, these guys like a Heston and Peck were contemporaries and were very much friends, just as Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart, while they were different politically, were. There was a time, and if you have younger listeners, might be surprised to know that people of all political beliefs actually got along.
Isn't that
yeah,
weird?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so strange yeah. now. It's so polarized,
yes.
and it's
well,
scary.
And the weird
scary.
Thing about, you know, Charlton Heston, as he reminded us too, I mean, you know, he was an NRA guy and mm-hmm. he had conservative beliefs, but he also marched in the civil rights marches.
Yes,
in
I've
the
seen
early
pictures. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
he was front and center with that stuff. So, you know, I mean, it's like I say, not all cut and dried all the time.
No, it
people,
isn't.
Especially with the older actors. You
no.
know,
but, yeah. I want to ask, you know what film I really loved, and I think so many people have not seen it, and I think Fred Astaire was amazing in it, Ava Gardner, and Gregory Peck, and
oh,
Anthony Perkins
on
the Beach.
Yeah.
It is not a party film, that's for sure.
No.
But it is a great film. And he, Fred, non-dancing part, he played a racer, and
yeah.
And they were in Australia. He was amazing in that role, I thought.
Yeah, I think, again, he and Kelly, you know, I think were passable mm. straight actors. And, you know, Stanley Kramer, of course, sort of like the 50s, 60s king of sort of the social, you
yes.
know, message films.
Yeah,
I think it's a terrific film. And
the whole, the whole nuclear, you know, and, you know, nuclear war message that, I mean, it's still pertinent, you know, as long as nuclear weapons are around.
It will always be
pertinent,
unfortunately, until we all blow up or an asteroid hits us 2,000 years from now.
Yeah, not a great date film, though.
No, but it's such a good film. Lucille Ball, I like how you guys did that one. Where is it? The Knot. What did you call her, Lucille Ball? I'm trying
Nothing
to find
at all.
Out. No,
not having
just,
a ball with Lucy,
yeah,
probably. Or something
yes,
like that.
She
yeah,
she
yeah.
is a very serious person, and she got kind of mad at you guys, right?
Well, she was mad only because when we did research, because we didn't have the luxury of internet and anything, you know, we had read somewhere in a current biography that she had run away from her home in Jamestown, New York. And she said, that's scandalous, that don't believe any of that. If this is where the interview is going, I don't want any part of it. And of course, Tom and I were young guys. We were mortified because the last thing we wanted to do was piss off Lucille Ball. And we were able to right the ship. And, you know, it turned out to be a very productive and I think informative interview. But yeah, I think the takeaway from Lucy is she was the first woman mogul. Her and Desi started Desilu Productions.
Yeah.
And so she was more of a, just as much, if not more of a businesswoman. She came in with I Love Lucy. And as she said, there was no ad-libbing. We had great writers who knew our characters. We came in, read the lines, and did our job. And she was just matter of fact.
Funniest person she's ever met in her life that she thought was the funniest was Dean Martin.
Yeah.
She just said he was a crack-up. He was absolutely hysterical. And that's coming from Lucy, so we always thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, I think Dino seemed like a nice fella.
Everyone loved Dean Martin. We never had the pleasure of meeting. But yeah, Dean was...
You
Dean,
met him?
Like, no,
no, we never did.
Said. He was Dean was the from what, everything we've read and heard, you know, the ultimate laid back, easygoing, likable guy.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta ask you, have to ask you guys. My dad's been dead a long time, but I always think of him with Angie Dickinson because that was his girlfriend. That was his dream girl. He loved him some Angie Dickinson. So how was Angie when you visited her?
She was wonderful. All you needed to do, and probably to this day, she lives up in the high hills of Beverly Hills. Is all you need to do is get a like a latte from a certain Starbucks on Ventura Boulevard, and if you bring that up to her, she'll open her door and you can chat with her. She was, you know, that was her one request. She said, "If you're coming, you got to bring me a coffee from Starbucks." So
she's, you know, a great lady. We had two interviews with her. She wrote a wonderful blurb on the book. Very funny lady. Certainly has hobnobbed and, you know, been close personal friends with, you know, all those, the Rat Pack
and JFK.
Yes, that's why she wouldn't ride her. They wanted to give her.
And she was just profiled.
Humongo money, you know.
CBS Morning News just did a profile. Yes. She's 88, I believe.
She looks fabulous. Yeah.
She does. She actually, and she has that same voice, that sort of kittenish, really low register purr. I mean, it's just, she is exactly the same, you know, as you remember from,
Ben,
you know,
Policewoman
and the movie.
That was a trend-setting show, too, you know, Policewoman. Yep.
She was the lead of that kind of a show. What I found interesting was that she had only seen Earl Holliman one time. He played her, who was he here? Her partner?
He was a police officer.
Yeah. And he was on Policewoman with her, and she had not seen him in 30 years. And he lived, like, 8 miles away or something, and they finally got together.
Yeah, and then they met up. They finally met up. Yeah. And she said they met up, and it was like yesterday when they had, you know, which is what they always say when you're a good friend, a great friend, you can just pick up where you left off no matter how much time has elapsed.
That's true.
What she did with Earl,
That is the truth. So Angie gave you some Trader Joe's wine.
He did, two buck chuck.
Mike Connors,
Angie likes her two-buck chuck. Don't ever make jokes about two-buck chuck being rot gut, because she loves that two-buck chuck.
A lot of people do. They like their Trader Joe wine. I don't know. I'm not into Trader Joe's.
I like Robitussin, too, I guess.
Yes, you could. How about this one I want to see? So you did the last interview with Mike Connors, and he was also very loyal to his wife, and he turned down that vixen of vixens, Lana Turner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was kind of a weird deal. He had visited the set where she was making a movie because he knew someone there that was some sort of an office guy, and he was just watching it, and he's a good looking guy, and she noticed him and asked, basically, hey, you want to get together or come to my dressing room and this and that? he was newly married. He said, well, no, I just can't do that. But by the time he drove home, it had gotten all over the set. And by the time he drove home, his wife had found out about this, what had happened. Because one of her friends that had been at the studio had heard the rumor and then had called her. So when he walked in the door, she said, "So what is this thing with Lana Turner?" And he said, "Well, what? I couldn't, but, you know," it was like a 10-minute drive, and it was already, his wife was, you know, giving him the third degree. And he said, I would not be here today with her in the other room if I had taken Lana up on her offer. So it all worked out well.
Well, Lana was quite the Mickey Rooney was rather crassly described an encounter with Norma Shearer in his interview with you. And Norma was pretty down to earth, you know, even though she was married and she played Grand Dames. She went out with George Raft after her husband died. Yeah. She was an interesting character, and Mickey was. But the sad part about Mickey's life is that he ended up being a victim of elder abuse.
Yeah, and he was like, here's a guy who you know, made millions and millions, number one star in the world. He fought over his estate, and sadly, when he did eventually pass away a few years ago, they said his estate was valued at $20,000. Mm. It's just very sad ending to
very
his life.
Sad.
And he was abused verbally, and they beat him up.
They were ping-ponging him amongst different family members, exactly.
Awful.
He was a pawn.
He was sort of a meal ticket too. I think
of course.
Some family members. They kind of, you know, here, Mickey, show up here. We, you know, or this or that, or we can make money off you.
That makes me so sad.
Later in life, they were selling. You know, to do an interview, they were charging to do an interview later on.
And he was pretty. He was not with it towards the end.
No,
I hope.
Even we saw him when he was lucid and he was just sort of unpredictable.
Cranky.
But yeah, the last couple of years was coming out of his mouth was, I mean, pure fabrication to some extent.
Well, as RJ said during the interview with him, I mean, you know, when he said, when he knew that we had interviewed Mickey, he said, Mickey's certifiably insane. I mean, he said it sort of in a loving way, but he said, Mickey is just off his rocker. And we said, yeah, well, he's not a giant leap from the Andy Hardy movies when you meet the guy. I mean, he's just like, wow, you know, I mean, he's an electric wire, but, you know.
I got to ask you then, let's do, I don't know how much longer you guys have because we've gone 40, 49.
Well, I have to get to my class soon.
But I want to ask you one more question about the RJ. Oh, two more questions. RJ interview. Did he talk, I think it's obscene that they're that guy's coming out and they said that he murdered Natalie. If anyone's been drunk, way drunk like they were, I can imagine having a fight.
Well, yeah.
Her getting mad, blacking up, going there and doing
that. You know, Tom and I have been asked about that, and, you know, we get the, you know, the RJ hates from people in the, you know, anonymous people, I should say. The reality is, the daughters RJ had with Natalie love him. They're all close. They're all loyal. You're right. There was alcohol and some shenanigans going on. We'll never know. But RJ has been nothing but generous, and he's been a huge asset to the Hollywood community and a huge proponent and keeper of the flame for everything we're talking about, the golden age.
Oh, my God. I know.
He fell in love.
Barbara Stanwyck, and he fell in love on Titanic, and they had a long-term relationship. And all this great stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I like him. I think he tells
marvelous stories. RJ's great. I have nothing but good things to say about that guy.
The book was wonderful, and I love you guys.
You.
They have so much to talk about, so many interviews we didn't do. I'm talking to David. Your name is Fantel, right?
Yeah, that's close enough.
Well,
that's
how do you say it?
Fantel, but that's close. Like Mickey Mantle.
No, okay. David Fantel, like Mickey Mantle. Yeah. And Tom Johnson, who may or may not.
Yeah, you can't call Johnson that name. You know, I mean, there's no way.
Yay. So, who may or may not look like Art Carney. I'd love it if you guys could send me Fred Astaire picture that got you the in crowd. And everybody, check out their book, Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interviews with Golden Age Legends. It is a great book. We didn't even touch on half of the people that they interviewed. It was amazing. I loved it, you guys. I will reread it again.
Well, thank you, Grace.
Thank you, Grace.
Yeah, and thank you guys for going out there and getting those interviews and coming on the show because I love those people. And it was such a pleasure to read and to talk to you guys who got to meet them.
Well, thank
really
you very much, and I'm glad we persisted, and I'm glad we made this work.
I had a lot of fun, you guys. Thank you so much.
Okay, take it easy.
Take care, Grace.
Take care, guys. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Bye-bye.
You're just too marvelous for words like glorious, glamorous, and that old standby amorous. It's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough. I mean, they just aren't swell enough. You're much too much, and just too very, very to ever be dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
love talk from.